Evaluative and curious, of course. That was his job. But also possibly some unmediated impulse related to sympathy. She wanted to go straight to the Spotswood Hotel and find that man and kiss the back of his writing fist in acknowledgement of a shining moment of honor. Every day, the several Richmond papers arrived at the Gray house, and V usually read most of them, trying to understand the city. She made note of interesting, strange, and awful stories in her journal. 5/11/1861. Letter to the editor concerning Dixie as national anthem. I make no objections to the tune. It is bold and even pleasing. But the words, what are they? Mere doggerel stuff from the brain of some natural poet away down in Dixie, quote, that undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns, unquote, because no one as yet has ever reached it. 7/5/1861. Found. A little Negro child, between 3 and 4 years old, calling herself Betsy, yesterday evening at the new fairgrounds. The mother or owner can get her by paying for this advertisement. Apply to GEO Watt and Co. Plowmakers, Franklin Street. 8/30/1861. 5 Negroes, free and slaves, were apprehended Wednesday night by the watch while having a social gathering in the Lancastrian schoolhouse with dancing and other pleasing diversions. Being brought before the mayor yesterday, they were ordered to be whipped. 10/25/1861. Extraordinary freak. Considerable excitement was occasioned on 12th Street below Main yesterday afternoon by the appearance of a man dressed in a woman's clothing. He soon made himself scarce, and the police did not succeed in tracing him to his hiding place. 11/13/1861. The Spotswood Hotel will begin selling genuine Clicquot and G.H. Mums by the case. Also this day, free Negro ordered whipped for smoking a cigar in the street. So this was Richmond, a veneer of refinement over a deep core of brutality. And yet, the women from the best families calling her too Western, too frontier, too crude. Burnt Plantation, 1865. Sometimes the view from the ambulance included as high as a half dozen black house fire circles with stubs of singed rock chimneys rising like great mildewed gravestones. Empty, gray, split log corn cribs and slat-ribbed lost dogs. Dark, bloody smears in the dirt from the Union's hog and cattle butchering. Hardly any chickens to be seen, and those few gone wild and lank, little more meat to them than a hungry squirrel. Empty, unplowed spring fields grew nothing but swaths of ragweed. Sometimes, as the fugitives passed refugee camps, people raised their eyes, dim as if they were dead already. Proof positive of Sherman's notion that unarmed farmers and their families were a great deal easier to conquer than armies. Mostly the colors of that land stuck to shades of red dirt and black cinders with a few dashes of sickly green. And yet look up, and the sun burned yellow, and the sky rolled blue and deep like a strong argument that the world had not gone wrong at all. Crossing the wide path of Sherman's army, flux ruled every moment even 4 months later. In that scoured territory, people divided into three categories: raiders, refugees, and fugitives. The raiders moved fast, at a gallop, going from one easy target to the next, saddlebags heavy with plunder bouncing and flapping against their horses' rumps. Refugees trudged the roads day and night, ravaged by history, people dragging their last spotted pig by a hemp rope around its neck, a precious black Dominican chicken riding bright-eyed under an arm. Packs of children, faces blank as empty pages, took turns pushing wheelbarrows heaped with quilts and cookware and canvas for pitching lean-tos. Hardly a horse or mule to be seen, since Sherman and the raiders took the ones they could use and killed the old and weak for target practice. These fugitives traveled slowly, stuck to the back roads, tried not to call attention their way. On the road, the refugees all coughed. Sometimes V could hear the deep rattle in their lungs, their hawking and spitting, before she could see them. Sometimes refugees traveled mixed together, black and white, unclear what rules applied when elemental concepts like slave and free suddenly became uncertain. Former slaves, whole plantations of them, followed after the Northern Army, hoping to be fed and cared for. And then mostly, they had their few possessions stripped from them before being told to move along. Some, lacking a better idea, returned to the plantations they came from. But V met others still wandering the roads, looking for something hard to articulate beyond the vague but essential word, freedom. Bands of people as high as 25 or 30 members roamed with no money and no real sense of how money worked. For most of them, their only knowledge of the world was what little had been afforded them within the tight boundaries of a plantation. One lone man, barefoot, wearing half-leg pants and a collarless linen shirt, carried four rifles by their leather slings and three pistols in overlapping holsters around his waist. He said, now that he was free, he aimed to be an American, and he knew you needed guns for that. A black girl, maybe 8 or 9, led an old white man, half blind and mostly deaf, and holding a rusty ear trumpet. She carried what had been a smoked hog leg by its foot. They'd shaved the meat away to a few maroon petals clinging to the bone. Heart of the Wasteland. The day pressed, deeply humid, air laden so heavy with moisture and pollen that the color of the sky was a matter open to argument. The edges of things, tree leaves, tree bark, the features of a loved one's face, from 50 feet away, looked soft and blurred, barely identifiable. They stopped in the remains of an empty one-street town, houses and a few stores scattered on either side of the main road. Two of the buildings were painted white, and the rest varied in color depending on how long the bare wood siding and shingles had faced the weather. They walked into a half-burned hotel. A dark-headed girl played a dreamy nocturne at the lobby piano, notes spaced at careful intervals. "Are rooms available for the night?" The girl looked around, confused, her face the color of cake flour and her eyes dark. She said, "Nobody's here. The piano still plays, so I thought I'd play it. Is there someone we could ask about rooms? Everybody's gone, and nobody cares. Look on the second floor. Go left at the top of the stairs. Some of those rooms might still be dry." V said, "Please keep playing." The girl stood up and closed the key lid. She said, "I don't care for an audience." Those strange days, a lot of people used up parts of themselves they could never regenerate. Everyone in the territory they passed through had lost so much and were being offered many thousands in federal gold, money to last a lifetime, if they provided information leading to the capture of the fugitives. Who would blame hungry people for claiming such a treasure? They passed through rolling country for a few days, and the towns seemed little more than collections of sheds, but they took names from Greek and Roman cities. V remembers an unexpected steep hill pitching down to just a little creek, the way the horses squatted on their hocks against the grade. It was sunset, but people stood by the side of the road and stared, and when V said, "Good day," they looked away without a word. Then a day where they didn't even break camp, hard rain from dawn to sunset, lightning and thunder making the children shriek. After the rains, they traveled 3 days through drowned pine land, where mosquitoes flew so thick the fugitives couldn't sleep even when they dragged bedding directly into the smoke of the fire. More time went lost when everyone except Bristol and Ryland fell sick, a terrible purging. For 3 days, unrelenting fever and chills and raging bowels. The children were pitiful, and the adults alternated sleeping and rushing into the woods. Delray tried to take care of the horses and mules, but stopped over and over to hump with his hands on his knees and heave. Same for V and Ellen when they tried to comfort the children. The Navy boys, so young they still grew pale down on their cheeks and shaved only out of vanity, worked dawn to dark, doing the best they knew to nurse them all. Fetch water and clean children busy vomiting and having the flux. Whenever an adult could sit up to take liquids, they would steep herb tea or brew a bit of precious coffee. The children suffered better than the rest. They fretted and cried, and their faces became gray with dark circles under their eyes, but they also slept a lot. Frantic and desperate 1 minute, and then the next, without transition, dead to the world. Unconscious yet still sucking a thumb, at least the youngest ones. When they all recovered enough to travel, they only went 2 hours and then stopped for a day by a pretty river to wash and dry a pile of filthy linens. Then for 2 clear days and nights, they passed through country with few people and smooth roads. They went nearly 20 miles in 1 day, the first and only time. Late afternoon, they took a side road to avoid passing through a town. For a moment, V could see houses and stores distant across a cotton field growing up in weeds, no one in sight. Rain fell slow, and smoke from chimneys sank low to the ground. Then, up ahead, a group of people came around a bend in the road ahead. They were wet and carried hoes and shovels and rakes over their shoulders, the way men carry long rifles when they're walking a distance. These were farmers, willing to plant fields without mules or slaves in a time of so much disaster and uncertainty that it took great faith and hope to gamble on a harvest months into a future that looked a shambles. It was too late to do anything but keep moving toward them. The fugitives had agreed that in such circumstances, Delray should do the talking. So V ducked under the canvas with the children and tried to keep them quiet, but they were in a talking mood, so the best she could do was make a game out of whispering and sign language. As they passed the farmers, V could hear their questions and Delray's answers. "Who is the lady?"
"Mrs. Jones."
"Where are you coming from?"
"Up the road a ways."
"Where are you heading?"
"Down the road a piece."
"Pretty nice bunch of horses and mules."
"Because we've not allowed anybody to steal them from us."
"Who's these other people?"
"Family members."
"Any news of the war?"
"It's done's all I hear," Delray said.
"Heard some fool shot Lincoln and killed him. That true?"
"You know more than I do," Delray said.
"If it is true, we'll all pay for it."
"Shit.
As far as I know, Lincoln or not, we're all paying every minute of every day," Delray said. He flapped the reins and 100 yards on, leaned around and said, "If somebody comes up behind asking the right questions,
I doubt they'll have forgotten us.
Twilight the next day, a storm began brewing far westward. Clouds lit up with pale blooms of distant lightning, faint thunder. The wind blew the storm their way, and it looked like a bad night to be on the road. An hour later, lightning flashed a couple of miles away, jagged bolts. Rylan walked toward a dark plantation house, one end burned to nothing but black, crazed timbers in a heap, and tall Doric columns scorched halfway up. Empty fields, deserted rows of facing slave cabins off to the side. Thin wisps of human-shaped smoke rose from the burn pile and stood in the last beams of moonlight pinched off through a closing crack in the clouds. Lightning struck nearby, and then immediately a swelling sound like shredding metal. Rushing wind climbed the hill and whirled limbs of pecan trees. In the flashes, stacked parallel rows of sapsucker holes in the trunk bark, bands of black dots, appeared and vanished immediately like unreadable lines of ancient text, a false prophecy. Big, greasy drops of rain, widely spaced, hissed as they fell, and off in the woods, a yap of distant dogs carried in the stirring air, faint and wave-like in rhythm. Delray said, "That's the very way dogs sound when ghosts are roaming." They stayed in the dark, watching, ready to flee, while Rylan walked under the pecan trees and climbed the steps to the front porch. Horizontal jags of lightning silhouetted him. He knocked on the door, acting like a gentleman, and then tried the knob. The door swung open. He humped over against the wall to shield a match and lit a candle and went inside. One by one, the windows of the front rooms lit up yellow as he scouted and then went black when he searched the back rooms. Soon the light grew brighter in increments as he pilfered around and found candle stubs and lit them. He came back onto the porch.
"Empty!" he shouted.
The rain picked up and they all hurried unloading. Ellen carried Winnie under her shawl, and Burton led Maggie and Jeffy. Jimmy Limber and Billy walked fast across the weedy plot of lawn holding V's hands. Bristol and Ryland ran back and forth in the flashes of storm, carrying food and bedding, while Delray settled the mules and horses under the trees. Then all three of them collected downed limbs and broke them up the best they could, stomping them into firewood. Inside, V and Ellen sat with the children and arranged their nest of quilts in front of the cold hearth. The house was all chaos, gommed up beyond belief. Everywhere scattered plunder, broken things. A wide, dragged trail parted the clutter. All denominations of Georgia bills littered the floor, and Burton drew the worthless paper together to strike a fire. A few $1,000s did the job. Twigs and spindles from dining chairs served as kindling. Black windows flashed white, projecting images of pecan limbs like etchings against the glass, and then went black again. The fire caught, and the chimney drew. Burton closed the curtains to keep firelight from showing down at the road. The Navy boys took candles and went exploring the back of the house, and returned shortly with a crock of strawberry jam and another of dark-colored honey, almost coffee black. Ryland said, "There's a case of wine sitting back there if anybody would care for some." "Yes, please," V said. She began digging around in her reticule down past her pretty pistol and came up with a corkscrew. Ryland set the case of Chablis down beside her, and she opened a bottle. "Did you notice wine glasses?" she said. "Be right back," Ryland said. He and Bristol returned, with Bristol carrying the candle and Rylan holding six stems upside down between spread fingers, and the bowls chimed against each other as he walked. Burton and Delray stood on either side of the fire. Delray's clothes hung dark and nearly soaked on his frame, and as the fire heated up, he started steaming. Rain fell hard, and drops sizzled in the hearth where they found a way down the chimney throat. No milk for the children, and everybody too weary for much cooking, V said, "A good night for bacon and warmed-up biscuits." Delray said, "Good Lord. Few more days like this and we'll be shoveling for terrapin eggs along the creek banks." V said, "Delray, I count on you for optimism." "Scrambled terrapin eggs, mighty good eating. Tastes like duck eggs, but with a lot more tang." "Thank you for the effort," V said. Ellen fried 2 skillets of thick cut bacon and then fried the old dry biscuits in the grease for a minute to freshen them up. The sound carried from the second floor, a squeak of floorboards, a bump, then silence. Burton said, "No worries. Just a possum or a bird that's gotten in and can't get out. But the boys and I'll go check. If you hear anything more than just the 3 of us walking around, get out and go to the wagon. We've left the teams fed and in the traces and ready to roll if there's trouble." Burton and Bristol and Ryland went upstairs, searching for the source of the noise, and Delray waited near the fire with his shotgun ready. Hardly sooner than they got up the steps, V heard many feet thumping on floorboards, raised voices, the sounds of things falling. Ellen and Delray grabbed the younger children under their arms, and V yanked Maggie by the hand. They fumbled out of the house and into the rain. Winnie cried, and then most of the other children started crying. Before they reached the wagon, though, Burton came onto the gallery carrying an oil lantern in one hand and a pistol in the other. He said, "Ease up. Safe to come back, I think." Inside, a huddle of people crowded around the fire, remnants of 2 or 3 families formerly enslaved. A grown man and 3 grown women, and some exhausted and frightened children and 2 crying babies. And also a greasy blonde boy, about 16. Ryland held out a stubby pistol for V's inspection. It rested in his palm, hardly weightier than her little suicide shooter. Ryland said, "Not even any live loads in it. I pulled it off that one." He nodded toward the white boy, who grew less beard than the fuzz on a mullein leaf. Yellow strands of sticky-looking hair drooped across his forehead in front and hung limp to his shoulders in back. Everything about him glowed pallid and shiny. He wore what had once been a fine suit, now fraying at the collar and sleeves and cuffs, its carefully tailored structure wrinkled and broken down and bagged until it rode him like a spirit from the past. V looked to the women and said, "Are your people all right?" The white boy said, "Address your questions to me." Ryland looked around at Bristol and said, "Good Lord, that little one features himself the leader." V said, "Ryland, step back, please." The greasy boy lifted his 2 forefingers and abruptly hooked his hair behind his ears, as if he considered that a gesture of authority, or at least defiance. V looked him straight in the eye, and he glared back, about 2 seconds, and then looked down. She said, "Son, we're short on supplies, but would you like a biscuit with a little piece of bacon? Or a biscuit with some of your honey or jelly? One of those 3 choices, not all. We're sharing here, and what we have has to go around." You could see the gears engaging and the wheels beginning to grind with some effort. "Bacon," he said. "Bacon, please," V said. The boy just glared. "All right," V said. "We'll try again when you find yourself more composed. Meanwhile, enjoy the warmth of the fire we built. By the way, what's your name?"
"None of your damn business what my name is."
V looked back to the women, and one of them said, "He's Elgin." V said, "And what's your name?" Belle. They passed and shared food, including a bacon biscuit for Elgin, still sulled. He took a bite and stewed a while, and finally spoke up with great pent emotion. He swore that with the death of the Confederacy, he would pine down to nothing within a few months and be the last of the Confederate dead. V said, Elgin, if all you have to say is nonsense, stop talking. While you've been here hiding, everything's changed. It's not the same world out there. You need real plans, not fantasies.
I heard the government and army are moving to Texas. I might volunteer.
Ryland and Bristol both coughed a laugh. I've heard that same rumor about Texas over and over, V said. Nobody sane believes it. The war's dead and done. Lost. Think of a real plan. Starting with, for example, who holds title to this place? The boy looked puzzled. He said, How's that your business? Bell said, Probably he owns it. His daddy went out on the porch to stop raider trash picking through the leftovers after Sherman's army, carrying a shotgun against half a dozen. He didn't even get one barrel fired before they cut him down. And the mother, V said, died first year of the fighting, Bell said.
Brothers or sisters?
No.
Son, V said to Elgin, think hard about this place. It's a real thing, not some theory or philosophy or crazy dream. It could feed all of you.
I ain't feeding every stray slave in Georgia, and I ain't feeding y'all neither.
Ryland, real sarcastic, said, Brother Elgin, correct me if I'm wrong, but ain't we mostly feeding you? You're offering us shelter in return. Calm down and consider something. In your position, what would Jesus do? He'd say something about inviting strangers in, about how he loves a cheerful giver.
Elgin stood up and all fervent said,
Probably Jesus would yank you by your neck and then beat you to the ground like a drunk foreman with a long tomato stob. Don't be talking Jesus to me. Just say Jesus one more time and see what happens. Come on, say his name.
You forget, Ryland said, rising to his feet. We're the ones with guns. Since everybody else was doing it, Burton stood up too. He had his right hand in his coat pocket. Delray stayed where he was, leaning against the wall with the shotgun angled half down, watching close. Bristol kept his seat and regarded the moment. He said, Rye, maybe sit your ass down and shut your mouth for a whole minute.
Ryland sat, and then the others did too.
Bristol said, Can we leave Jesus alone? He deserves a rest now and then. When his minute ended, Ryland said, I'm curious, Elgin. With all your strong feelings about the Confederacy, how come you weren't in on the fighting? You're old enough.
Elgin said, I paid a dirt farmer to take my place like the law allows.
Ryland said, A study in courage. Mr. Elgin puts his money where his big, stupid mouth is.
Bristol laughed, and so did Delray and V. Elgin's face blazed hollyberry red.
Bell said, You have to allow for him. He's lost so much. 10 years ago on this place, 300 of us nearly. Cotton growing to the sky every way you looked. Hog pens and pastures with cows, lots of cotton, lots of corn and vegetables.
V said, After things settle, the land will still be worth something.
Elgin bristled and said,
Who'd be buying? Nobody, that's who. Nobody's got money. And whatever happens, I ain't hoeing cotton, or beans and corn and collards neither, or milking cows. I don't plan to live in a world without slaves. Besides, we made more money breeding slaves to sell than growing cotton, so maybe I'll go to Brazil, where the laws keep making sense. These people here want to think I'm responsible for them, but the truth is purely the other way around.
V looked at Bell, and Bell said, I wet-nursed him from the day he was born until he turned 3. It's hard for me to believe he hates me, and hard to hate him.
Not hard for me, Ryland said, in a whisper loud enough for everyone to hear. Elgin said, Shut the hell up!
The children dozed in front of the fire, piled together in a nest of quilts, except Jimmy Limber, who sat next to V, leaning a shoulder into her hip, a hand on her leg as she rubbed his back, cupped the side of his thin neck in her palm. He watched the freed children intently, and they looked back at him the same way, curious and confused. Belle said what they were all thinking. Whose baby is he?
Jimmy's mine, V said. He favors me a little.
Hmm? Belle said. Very quickly, Ellen said, Nobody knows who his mother was. We found him taking a whipping on the street in Richmond, so Miss V moved him in with her children. Been living there for a couple of years.
Polishing their shoes and fetching things? Elgin said. Or more like a pet.
Not either one, Ellen said. They all slept in the nursery, played and had classes, all the children together.
Good Lord, Elgin said. You think you've heard every manner of shit there is to hear, and then some crazy bitch comes up with something new.
Ryland rose slowly, eased his pistol out of his belt and held it down by his leg. He said, Little man, that kind of talk ain't at all Christian. V looked at Burton, and Burton looked at Ryland and said very low, We can't afford to go around killing people for every stupid thing they say. We've all agreed on that. Stay calm.
Ryland put his pistol back in his belt and said, Now and then, though, it's the exception that proves the rule. He said it very bright, trying to hold the corners of his mouth level.
Burton announced to the room, We need some sleep, and all of us will sleep right here by the fire. One of us will be awake all the time. I'll take the first watch.
You think you're going to put a watch over us in my own house? Elgin said.
Delray said, No judgment as to need, but we're going to do it the way we're going to do it. He raised the angle of his shotgun barrel about an inch and said, I bet we all need to visit the outhouse now that the lightning's quit. I'll stand guard outside and make sure everybody's safe. After they'd all gathered back around the fire, Elgin said,
I'd been wondering how in hell y'all up in Richmond managed to lose the war. And then you show up on my doorstep and it's clear as day. Worthless people.
Could have been they outnumbered us, Ryland said. But all the way down here, I've been thinking maybe we had it coming.
Had what coming?
Losing, Ryland said.
Say that again,
Elgin said.
You heard me. I don't like to kill people unless I'm sure they need it. So say it one more time and I will lay you down.
Rye said, You've not ever worn a uniform or killed anybody, and you're not going to start now. Have you even had your first drink of liquor? The boy reached to his waist and pulled out a little hidden derringer, silver-plated with pearl grips, 3-inch over-under barrels. Ryland and Bristol both laughed at him when he held it out. V said, Boys, stop it right now, and you, Elgin, don't say another word.
I don't let women run me, Elgin said.
He kept his little pistol leveled at Ryland. Rye couldn't pass up a jab. He said,
Except apparently that woman over there has not long since finished nursing you.
Diapering too, probably. He gestured toward Belle hovering nearby. She said, Mr. Elgin, don't pay attention to their rough talk. Burton Harrison stood and spread his hands and said, "Wait." V stood too and said, "Enough." And then Elgin twitched a finger, almost a nervous impulse, and an awful instant of time later, Ryland was gone for good. Bristol stood there with a look of stunned recognition on his face at just the stupidity of it, just the damn overwhelming thoughtless ignorance and meanness and darkness of humans. Ryland lay with a hole burned in the weave of his left jacket lapel, all the light gone out of him. Whatever fills the bloody mess inside our heads, the details that make us who we are, those threads of nerve and strange, ugly tissues that make us different from each other, Ryland's had quit working, shut down all at once. He'd transformed in a matter of seconds from being so busy living, fired up and blazing and tiring people down to a nub most days, to being a dead pile of meat and bones and gristle without a spark. 3 or 4 swings of a pendulum, and he was all gone. Elgin shifted his little pistol slightly toward Bristol and sort of smirked. In the instant it took Ryland to die, Bristol didn't have time to think or to choose, as if something in him beyond thought didn't wish to occupy the same world as Elgin. Bristol drew his navy pistol and pulled 2 shots faster than the mind could register, 1 hole in the forehead and an ugly red mess blowing out the back onto the plaster wall. 1 heartbeat, and all that bragging falsehood Ryland made up on the rail platform in Richmond became prophecy. Elgin wasn't surprised any more than a candle flame is surprised when you lick your fingers and pinch it out. Light, then dark. He fell as if he had just suddenly decided to lie down, but he was dead before he hit the floor. And before Bristol even recognized what he'd done, V wheeled and slapped him hard, a roundhouse blow to the side of his head. He still held his smoking pistol aimed toward the space the dead boy had occupied before collapsing. Ryland lay peaceful, 10 feet away as if asleep, and Bristol looked too stunned to form tears in his eyes. V looked at the 2 dead boys and back at Bristol and began to view that arrangement of bodies anew, as a feature of her current world needing to be understood. She said, "I'm sorry I did that." She tried to hug Bristol, but he wouldn't stand still for it. All the children, both groups, either cried and wailed or were too terrified to move. Bell's people hushed their children and put themselves, their bodies, between their children and V's people. Billy had burrowed up under the pile of quilts and lay sobbing. Maggie still had her eyes closed and held her hands over her ears, and Jeffy and Jimmy stared at the bodies in disbelief. V and Ellen and Burton got to their knees and hugged the children and patted heads and tried to turn the little boys away, but Jimmy and Jeffy kept looking back at the bodies and the blood. Delray stayed where he was, with the shotgun ready, and watching everybody closely. When it seemed like the shooting was done, Belle went to Elgin and touched his neck where the pulse would have been, and then she took an indigo kerchief from her apron pocket and spread it over his face. "What are we going to do now?" Belle said. "Sunrise. New world," Bristol said. Dawn, just a haze to the east, V and Ellen carried the sleeping children out to the ambulance in blankets while Delray tacked and harnessed the horses. Burton and Bristol dug 2 holes in the plantation cemetery. No boxes, just red rectangles cut deep in Georgia clay. Wide pine floor puncheons for markers, names and dates scratched by knife point. When they finished digging and had the bodies settled, Belle and her people came out of the house and stood over their little dead master before he got shoveled under. V came from the ambulance and stood with Bristol and Burton. Belle looked down in the hole at Elgin, arms crossed and a handkerchief over his face, She turned to Bristol and said, I think you ought to say some words.
You knew him since he was a baby, Bristol said. You should say something in his favor.
Not my place. Bristol turned to Burton, and Burton lifted his shoulders a fraction.
V looked Bristol in the eye and gripped his wrist a second and nodded yes.
Bristol stepped up to the hole and said,
I didn't have one thing against you, Elgin. All we wanted was to get out of the rain. We didn't know this place was anything but a burnt plantation. We shared our food. I'd made it through my part of the war without killing or getting killed. And then you shot Rye for no reason but ignorant pride. I'll never forgive you, and I'll try every day to forget you. But I probably won't be able to. You don't deserve to be remembered 1 minute past right now. I'm done talking. And if anybody here wants to argue, this is the time.
Belle's people looked at each other, and then Belle said, I wish you'd finish by saying those words you said last night.
New world coming, Burton said.
Yes, Belle said. That'll do. The freed slaves turned and walked back toward the burned plantation house. Delray left the horses and walked over to the graves and removed his hat. Rylan rested, chalky, in the bottom of his hole. Bristol climbed down and X'd Rylan's forearms over his chest and heaped clean-smelling pine boughs to cover him. When Bristol finished all the tasks except the shoveling, V said, Do you want to say something? Bristol said, Rye's gone. And what he'd want would be for me to tell a joke. But I don't know anything funny enough right now. Bristol patted palm to chest 3 times and started shoveling. When he had a mound of red Georgia clay, he pitched the shovel away and walked to the horses and wagons. V walked with him. She said, Did you mean that? About worrying you'll remember that boy forever. Bristol said, I won't even know whether I meant it for a long time. But right now I'm more afraid your children will dream all their lives about the killings. Pictures of me with a gun in my hand triggering the last shot. V touched his shoulder and said, They're so young. I'll shape their memories so last night won't be anything but thunder and lightning and a warm place in a nest of quilts by the fire. The fugitives headed on down the road toward Terra Florida, escaping to its wildness and freedom. Ryland's mule trailed on a hemp line from the back of the wagon, trotting easy, without a burden. James watches the landscape flow across the rail car window, left to right. A sprinkle of rain beads on the glass and deepens the greens of grass and leaves. He looks over his notes from the day, and at the end, he writes, I don't even know whether past feelings and memories deserve any respect at all. Maybe they're no more important than a pinch of pain from an injury decades old. Feelings and memories rise and pass every day like the weather, only important at the moment. Why not just notice them and let them go? Fifth Sunday. Saratoga Springs. I have questions too, V says. Such as, where did you go after Miss Botoum? You were with her, what, a year, 2 years? What happens after this? She turns to the end of the chapter called Jimmy in the blue book and reads, Finally, the little boy drifted into Auntie Gwyn's home. This noble woman placed him where he was well-trained in all ways, having the advantage of school as well as a good practical education until he was old enough to support himself. Drifted, V says. Like a tiny hobo carrying his bindle on a stick over his shoulder? I doubt it. So how was it? She dropped you off at an orphanage and said, so long? Or just found someone already going that direction to give you a ride? I don't imagine she was under arrest by the federal government at the time she let you go, or had a gun to her head. James waits a moment for her to settle. He draws a couple of breaths and then tells V he hardly remembers Auntie Gwyn's orphanage, having been there only briefly. Before he found Miss Botoum's book, he couldn't even recall the name of the place. For 2 years previous to arriving there, his world had changed radically month by month. Places and people blur. That orphanage rests in his mind as one picture. A room filled with lots of white children. That's all. But he does remember that soon he went to Thompson Island Farm School, a mile out in Boston Harbor. Wealthy people, particularly Universalists and Unitarians, paid for it as a way of making the world a little better. Not all the boys were orphans, so some went home for holidays. The school aimed to help those who needed help, but the boys had to be smart and promising and willing. The main building, a big white house, sat on an open hill looking over the water. They could see the city from the third floor windows, but it felt like looking at the moon through a telescope. Interesting to observe, but not your world. His world was the island, and most of his memories begin there. He took classes in literature, mathematics, geography, history, logic, and science. And along with studying, all the boys worked for the good of their little community. The younger boys had jobs around the big house, so James started out helping in the kitchen and in the garden. Even now, he still grows a small backyard garden with greens in the cool months, tomatoes and squash and beans in the summer. All the boys lived on the third floor, in big rooms, like he remembers in Richmond with V's children, except more beds and closer together. Lots of rules about laundry and personal cleanliness. Good, V says. Boys that age can never wash too often. James tells her that the school had a big brass band. He played bugle. Sometimes they put on their uniforms and went out to the beach to greet passenger ships entering Boston Harbor, trumpeting marches to celebrate a successful crossing of the Atlantic. Passengers stood at the rails and waved handkerchiefs as they passed. The island spanned enough land, good dirt, to grow orchards, hayfields, berry patches. The older boys each had a little flower garden to tend, and spring through fall, they kept the big house bright with reds and yellows and whites. Fat clams grew on the sandbars, and boys sometimes went out with buckets and spades to bring back dinner. Older boys lived in a sort of village of tiny white cottages with green shutters. They elected their own mayor and held community meetings to decide how to deal with problems, how to punish boys who wouldn't work or who pilfered. One large room in the main building was the library, and James spent a lot of rainy Sundays in there. There were 6 long study tables, and the books were mostly donated, some quite old. He liked brown, antiquated travel books describing trips that weren't possible anymore, explorations of the Western Hemisphere back when much of it was still unmapped. Pretty days of spring, summer, and fall, he spent all his free time outside, either walking the island or sitting under a tree with a book. The headmaster and staff searched out our aptitudes, James says, and when I reached 13, I began teaching reading and arithmetic and geography to the youngest boys. In some form, it's what I've done ever since. Pretty days in late summer, though, he always volunteered for haying, forking the cut and dried hay onto an enormous wagon until the heap stood 2 shaggy stories tall, and then riding on top back to the barn, balancing on the shifting load. The fragrance of sun on cut grass swelling all around, itchy from the hay down your shirt, but feeling strong and tired and satisfied with the work. He also tells her about winters when the wind blew in from the North Atlantic and the snow came sideways against the windows and the big house swayed and vibrated in the storms. How one winter the harbor froze solid, and some of them walked over the ice to the shore a mile away. So, not a bad place, V says.
Very good place. A good school. Plenty of teaching and learning, but also plenty of physical work. The boys learned how to take care of the buildings and the animals and the gardens and orchards. You were putting your food on the table, literally. Not working to grow somebody else's food, growing your own. Your responsibility, your work, your enjoyment. We sold surplus from the gardens and orchards, and the money went back into the school for our benefit and for boys to come. You felt part of something. Out of 100 boys, fewer than a dozen weren't white, but that rarely mattered. Teachers judged us by how much we learned and how much we contributed to the work, not on color. Boys who didn't follow that same practice came and went quickly. Of course, the teachers who ran the school and the rich benefactors who paid for it were idealists, and if you said that all of us, white and black, may have finished school at 18 with a distorted and naive sense of the world off the island, you'd be right. When he finishes his story, James says, I know your feeling about taking notes as we talk, but I need to write something down. It's about me, not you.
Please, V says, scribble. James opens his notebook and writes, the island was a separate place, situated partway between America and the moon. Some clear nights out with the telescope, moon full or gibbous, I felt about equidistant between the sharp-edged craters and the sparkling lights of America across the harbor. I knew that off the island very particular rules and laws and customs about skin color and blood degree applied, that the entire stretch of country from ocean to ocean was a strange place with a very strict borderline, and that I didn't exactly fit on either side of it. Then, across the bottom of the page, in a larger, more swooping hand, he writes, the island felt like home to a degree I've never experienced before or since. After he caps his pen, V says, you're not even going to read it to me. Revision first. It makes us all better than we are. For now, tell me about our capture. Place of Dreams, May, 1865. They passed out of Sherman's path of punishment and went dragging down ordinary red Georgia roads, sloping south on their beaten way. Small towns and small farms lay wide-spaced among pine woods. The horses and mules were as tired as the people, and they made fewer than their average 10 miles a day. Florida still lay vague in the distance, and the only map forward might have been drawn in a crazy man's hand, speculating on a place V would never reach, no matter how long she traveled. Most days, Bristol trailed off the back, riding by himself. Delray kept reminding him he would need to hang a right at some point if he was heading for Alabama, but Bristol said maybe he'd go all the way until they hit the Gulf, and then he'd peel off west and follow the coastline around the curve to Mobile, take his time. V sat with him one day at their lunch stop and said, I know you're hurting two directions, for Ryland and for having killed Elgin. I'll point out that better boys than that one, hundreds of thousands of them on both sides, have gone down in this mess. So you consider Elgin a wharf fatality? Bristol said. I don't consider him anything. He pulled the trigger first, over nothing but words and ideas. But you pulled the trigger over something real. A mean, bloody act that took your friend's life. There's a difference. Don't let him weigh heavier on your mind than he merits. Yes, ma'am. Don't you yes, ma'am, me. This is too important to fall back on manners. A lot of boys would be strutting around, bragging like they'd killed their first buck. But that's not you. And that's why we're talking, I don't want what happened to ruin you for the rest of your life. I'm assuming your family had some money, or else you'd have been in the infantry instead of the academy. Some. My father has a business, not a plantation. Then go home. And when colleges open back up, finish an education. Do something that helps people get through the chaos. For a long time, it's going to be like Noah after the flood. Everybody, black and white, trying to understand what's left when the water drains away. Bad enough without having your mind overly darkened by that one instant. So we've all got a load of guilt to haul. That's my big lesson. Don't get sarcastic with me. I'm saying most of the load is not yours to bear. It's ours, the people who brought it on. When you get home, rest and start clearing your head from all this. And then go and do, Bristol. As they trudged south, V kept Bristol close and watched his moods. She wanted him sitting at her campfire every night, not going off to spread his bedroll alone in the pines. She and the children, and Ellen, Burton, and Delray, still usually sat an hour on low camp stools arranged around the fire, no matter how tired they were. Some evenings they barely spoke and looked at the flames like they'd been dazed by a great blast of black powder. Cool nights, Jeffy and Jimmy and Billy sat sprawling against each other, half asleep. Sometimes V would rouse up from such a moment of gloom and recite a poem. She would tell them all to attend and then look off into the dregs of sunset and tell them the name of the poem and of the person who wrote it, and then launch into something beautiful. V guessed Bristol and all the others were often too exhausted to listen close to the words, only the music of the poem, the tune of it. They could get all the meaning they needed right there in the rhythm without keeping up with grammar at all. That, and the flow of light from the fire moving on their circle of faces as she recited. At some point, most nights, she would decide her children looked or smelled dirty, which they all usually did. She'd take a pail of creek water warmed over the fire, a washcloth, and a worn flat of fragrant pink soap and start scrubbing. And if Bristol was sitting there, she'd scrub him too, forehead to collarbones, push his hair back and scour his blemished teen forehead. Run her finger covered with the soapy washcloth deep in his ears. When she was done, he glowed red as fire coals, his neck and face chafed near to bleeding. He'd smell like roses, and whatever fragrance that night's creek carried, pine needles or rotted leaves or minerals in the rocks. Some nights, V asked Bristol to tell a story. A tale from his time in the Naval Academy with Rylan, or one of their adventures journeying south from Richmond with Jeff. One night, he told about the remnants of the government in Greensboro, how some of the cabinet members and high officers had to sleep on pallets and boxcars. From Greensboro on past Charlotte, nothing but confusion and bad weather, blown up railroad bridges and muddy roads ahead, Sherman coming from the south, and Grant coming from the north to rub out the remainders of the Confederacy. Before long, what was left of the Confederate government and army traveled by horseback and wagon train. Day by day, rank meant less, and even the officers lost interest in giving and taking orders. The powerful men became too consumed with the deluge sweeping over their own personal worlds to worry about controlling underlings like Ryland and Bristol, who floated on, rode the tidal wave. They made themselves useful to Judah Benjamin and General Basil Duke, who had both so fully let go of rank that the boys weren't sure how to address either of them. Benjamin had occupied almost every position of power in the government, short of president. Call him Mr. Attorney General, Mr. Secretary, Mr. Senator, and he would laugh and say, "Oh, that's all gone. Call me by my first name. A band of outlaws should travel as equals." So that's what the boys called him, Mr. Judah. He traveled down the country roads, the most cheerful outlaw since Robin Hood. His trunk must have been at least half